Okay, let me start again. Good morning, everyone. Okay, when you're trained as a Buddhist, you don't think of Buddhism as a religion. You think of it really as a method or a way, oftentimes with a big W, a way that helps you examine your own actions and experiences for the purpose really of recognizing answers to questions like, this is what my mind is about. Or, this is what I should do to actually experience happiness. Or, this is what I must avoid if I want to avoid unhappiness. Or, this is what I should do if I really want to develop compassion, if you will, for people around me and for all of the world. At its heart, Buddhism is very practical. It's about doing things that foster confidence, compassion, happiness, and avoiding things that provoke things like unhappiness, ill will, uncomfortableness, etc. The essence of Buddhism is not so much an effort at changing our thoughts or our behavior, but actually at realizing that at heart we are already good, complete, and whole individuals. It's about recognizing inherent potential of our mind, what we call technically in Buddhism, Buddha nature. Now, so said another way, Buddhism is not so much concerned about becoming a better person, a well or good person, but in recognizing that we're already complete, well, and good as we are, right here now, even though we might feel confused, in our daily life, etc. The Buddha used a number of images to actually convey this idea of, really complete goodness in us. And one was, of course, the murky glass of water. Like a murky glass of water, you can't see the bottom. But if you let the glass sit, and the silt, etc., and the sediment settles, you can see that the water was always crystal clear. Always crystal clear. And it's just like our nature goodness. We have thoughts, we have unhappiness, we may be confused, but at our very nature, we have completeness and goodness, etc. Another image that we run across a lot of times in Buddhism is the idea of the dusty, smudged mirror. And a true polished mirror sees reality as it is, without judgment. It just reflects what it is. But when you look through the dust of a smudged mirror, you don't see reality. You are confused, etc. And still another image that you run across is a cloudy sky. And today's a good example. We all know if we could get in an airplane and fly up, and most of us probably have done this, if we actually fly up through the clouds and the mist, etc., we'll see that the sun shines and the sky is pure. And it's really the same kind of image, etc., that inside it's clear like the sky, though our natural goodness may be obscured by clouds and mist and things like this. Now, looking around, I can see you don't believe me. You don't believe me a bit, if you will. So my talk today is really a very practical one, and it's really about how we meditate and why we meditate, and about one of the problems in particular that arises that we think is a problem that I think we'll see ultimately is probably not a problem after all. So when I began to meditate many years ago, right here in the 1970s, etc., I did not really understand what I was doing. I lived about a mile away. I'd get up in the morning, and I could make a cup of coffee, and it was still hot when I got here. I lived so close, etc. Those days, we didn't come in the front door in the morning. We actually came in the back door. We went downstairs, put our coat up, came up and meditated, and there was no work period afterwards, so you never talked to anyone. And weeks and months would go by, and my wife would say, what's going on? what are people up to? And I'd say, I haven't talked to anyone. I haven't talked to anyone for months, etc. But I did come and I did practice and I did listen to Dharma talks. And the basis of my lack of understanding, and it took me a long time to understand this, was that I didn't truly recognize the real nature of mind. And that's what I'm talking about today. I had a basic understanding from reading books and listening to Dharma talks like this one, but I didn't have the kind of direct experience, of how mind can lead to confusion. It can be the mist in the clouds, if you will, that's kind of obscuring the sky, if you will. And so I had to learn, basically, that the strong emotions, whether good or bad, if you will, the discomfort, basically, that I feel, and we all feel this kind of discomfort, if you will, it was actually a product of my own mind, and that below the mind, basically, still I had a real solid base of serenity, confidence, and happiness, and all of that was closer to me than my own eyes. You know, there it was, inside, obscured all the time. Now, it's possible that people told me all of this, and that I read it, and I just didn't recognize it. And I think most of us have those experiences in life where people tell you things, etc. You hear things, you read things, and you just don't get it. And I think that was probably, I just wasn't ready. And one day I ran across a sentence by Kalu Rinpoche, who's a famous Tibetan Buddhist, that kind of gave me an inkling that what was going on. And he said, in starting out in the path, we have to go through the process of sitting down and examining the mind and examining our experience to see what is really going on. And let me say that again, because I think it's the real heart, basically, of our practice, particularly when we start. We have to go through the process of sitting down and examining the mind and examining our experience to see what is really going on. And I said, examining my mind, examining my experience to see what is really going on. That was really something new to me. So I had to learn, really, whatever problems I was experiencing in my meditation, etc., were habits of thought and perceptions that were really ingrained in my mind. And thanks to some of my teachers, I gradually began to recognize how feeble and transitory those thoughts are. And if you really look at your thoughts and you see that they lack substance, you know, they just pop up and go, if you will. And I learned that as these thoughts came up, that, you know, it's our kind of almost normal human habit to attach to small problems. So little things, whether good or bad, would suddenly become big things. You know, whether it was some attachment to some pleasure that suddenly I had blown it out of proportion, etc. Or perhaps there was some slight, small slight, and I had blown it up into something really big. And so just by sitting quietly, observing how rapidly, in many ways, illogically, my thoughts worked, etc., I began to see that thoughts really are not as solid, if you will, or real as they seem to be. And once I began to let go of the storyline, all of our thoughts tell storylines, and everyone's a little different, etc. And once I began to let go of that storyline, I began to understand, you know, what my meditation practice was about. Also, I found that looking at your thoughts made me realize that I was a witness. You know, you're the witness to your thoughts. And in a sense, you're not your thoughts, because you can actually observe your thoughts, and there they are. And by actually thinking of myself as a witness to my thought, it really gave some distance, if you will, and really made my thoughts have a less direct and powerful effect on myself. And I mean, there I am, just watching them, and here they are popping up. And I also became aware of the infinitely vast and really infinitely open awareness of what is our natural mind, our Buddha nature, if you will. And I learned the hard way my first year of walking the path my first few years. And I always say, why do I learn the hard way? You know, why always the hard way? And I think there'd be an easy way, if you will, that a theoretical or book understanding by itself is not sufficient, basically, to overcome the psychological and biological habits, you know, that we all have that kind of make us feel uncomfortable and obscure, really, our understanding of the world around us. And so for real information transformation to occur, I understood that theory has to be applied through practice. Theory has to be applied through practice. You can read books and go to Dharma talks and but eventually you have to practice, you know, whether it's on the cushion or some other way. The Buddha, who conveyed a lot of his lessons through imagery, referred to this point as a bird having two wings. And he mentioned a bird with only one wing can't fly. And likewise, just with understanding without practice, we don't wake up. And so that's really a powerful image to me, the thinking of understanding and practice as the two wings of a bird. And we know need both, basically, if we're going to wake up to our true nature. So if we want to settle that murky water, and if we want to try to polish the mirror, if you will, then we have to make some attempt to look at our mind. And so the question is, how do we do that? The key and the how of Buddhist practice is just learning to simply rest on a basic awareness of thoughts and feelings as they occur. Just simply rest on them. And this gentle awareness, if you will, this gentle resting on whatever occurs, whatever thoughts, sensations, images that come up, is referred to in Buddhism as mindfulness. Mindfulness, and I'm trying to avoid a lot of technical terms, but mindfulness is one we should be aware of. And so mindfulness is just simply resting on the mind's natural clarity, etc. It's that crystal clearness of water in that murky glass, if you will. And when you do this, and you're the witness and you're sitting back and you're watching your thoughts arise, etc., you find that eventually the power of your thoughts to affect you begins to fade, if you will. And you realize that really the natural function of the mind, what the mind does, is just to generate thoughts. The brain basically is a thought generator. And this is what it does. It's just the natural thing. So the idea that you're going to somehow stop all of these thoughts, etc., just doesn't occur. So thoughts arising are just like the natural ripples across the lake. You know, it's just part of the way things basically are. And so ultimately, as I sat here at retreats, like the retreat coming up very soon, etc., you know, I began to really watch my mind, and by watching my mind eventually began to change what was going on inside, etc. So how do we meditate? And we've had just a little bit of understanding of what we're trying to do, and I know it's very brief, but you know, we're trying to watch our thoughts, we're trying to understand where they come from, or understand how they affect us, etc. We understand that we can actually make a distance between ourselves and our thoughts so that their influence fades. Importantly, we understand that all of those thoughts basically are just the natural way of the mind, if you will. So again, how do we meditate? How do we go about doing this? And this is the practice side, wing of the bird, if you will. So we've had kind of the understanding wing. Now we have the practice wing, etc. And first, a few words about trying too hard in physical posture. And many people don't meditate or give it up soon after they start because they think meditation means that you sit in strange, twisted positions with a ramrod straight back, etc., for endless hours with a totally blank mind. And, of course, none of that basically is necessary.
Now you tell me.
Yeah. Exactly. First of all, sitting with your legs crossed and your spine ramrod straight, etc. Actually, your spine straight. And for Westerners, this is a difficult position to actually get used to. And it takes some training. And so it's not really necessary to get started. Usually, if you've taken introduction to Zazen upstairs, you learn Vairochana is seven point method of meditation posture, where you sit in a lotus or half lotus position, your spine is straight, etc., your head is down, your eyes are open, all of these things that you basically learn. But basically, to meditate, there's a simple 2-point meditation position, and that is just keep your spine straight, keep your body relaxed and as loose as you can. And as you walk through the day, or sit, or stand, or lie down, this is a good way to meditate. It's a much more flexible way of meditating. And we'll talk about that in a minute. As you walk, keep your spine straight, your body relaxed, etc. This reminds me of the old story about the champion swimmer. Who later in life decided, well, I'm going to meditate and calm my mind, if you will. And so he got on his mat and he started to meditate, etc. And he was just real stiff. And after a few days of all of this, etc., he complained to the meditation master that, I'm getting a headache, my shoulders hurt, my neck is stiff. I'm just having a hard time. And the meditation master says, when you swim, is that the way you swam? I mean, with your arms straight like this and everything tense? And, of course, the champion swimmer said, of course not. The way to be a champion swimmer is to keep the body completely relaxed but alert. You have to direct the muscles, but you want the legs are kicking, but they're completely relaxed, and same with the arms. And the meditation master says, that's the same way you meditate. So again, when you think about position, again, there's a balance, if you will, a balance between a kind of alertness and relaxation. And we all basically have to be aware of that and find that. And then second, about those hours and hours of meditation, you find after you practice for a while that 30 minutes isn't enough, 40 minutes isn't enough. And actually you get into the practice of meditation. Your mind's calm to a certain degree. You can sit there. I remember after one retreat some years ago, not at the moment, but some years ago, when I was meditating, I was so light and so present that I actually thought, if I was arrested and put in a cell and allowed just to sit there, this would just be glorious. It was a real feeling of just the lightness and presence and being. And you can lose that, by the way, etc. But particularly when you're beginning to meditate, and particularly if you have a pretty active mind, actually just meditating for a minute. Or half a minute is really sufficient, and this is why I talked about this two kind of pointed meditation position. You're walking around the lake, you're riding the bus, you're sitting at your desk someplace, you're in the kitchen cooking or whatever, and again you keep your spine straight, you relax, etc., and then you do a meditation, etc. And third, that blank mind. What about that blank mind, etc.? And again, when you learn something about the mind, as I mentioned, the mind, its natural function is just to generate thoughts. This is what it does. And so you can't, even if you wanted to, basically sit there without any thoughts. We have to have the idea that resting on the mind, resting on the thoughts, resting on the perceptions and images that come up is quite different than basically trying to stop the thoughts. And so sometimes you meditate and you're trying to stop your thoughts. You're trying to hold a kind of an emptiness, if you will, when what's involved in meditation is just gently, mindfully, etc., you know, resting on those thoughts, those perceptions, those experiences as they occur, etc. A Buddhist meditation does not involve in any way, etc., trying to make the mind a blank. You know, that's not what it's about, etc. The real point in meditation is to rest in a non-judgmental way of awareness of whatever arises, if you will. And that word judgmental, again, is an interesting one because most of us are taught as we grow up that some thoughts are better, more appropriate, more productive than other thoughts. But when you look at your mind, just as ideas and perceptions and images arising, etc., you realize that there are no good thoughts. There are no bad thoughts, etc. There are good actions and bad actions. You can hurt somebody. You can hurt the earth. But there are only thoughts, if you will, etc. So actually, meditation is really a very simple exercise, if you will. It's just resting gently on your thoughts as they arise, if you will. And that's all involved. For best results, etc., you try your best without worrying too much about the results. And if we actually work at meditation, we have a regular practice, you find that after a while, your thoughts begin to calm down, etc. Or at least you build some distance between yourself and your thoughts, if you will. And you realize again that your thoughts are not solid or as real as you actually think they are, if you will. And it's as though, again, the Buddha uses imagery, it's as if the dust and the smudge on the mirror is being cleared away. It's as if the sediment in the glass, if you will, is slowly settling so you can see the original crystal pureness of the water, if you will. And you begin to see that the stuff that arises in your mind is just so much what somebody called neuronal gossip, if you will. It's just ideas and things that come up that basically are a lot of beyond your control. My wife referred to it once as a cognitive popcorn, if you will. Yeah, just like a popcorn popper, this stuff just pops up in all these ideas, etc. If we sit and if we practice, eventually we realize, etc., that what we think and what we do are not these thoughts, etc., and we recognize really that shining essence. That shining essence that is our pure mind. So let's look at some practices, etc. Buddha actually suggested all kinds of meditational practices. And now his idea was that there are lots of different kinds of individuals, so there should be different kinds of meditational practices, for different individuals. And after he died, his followers actually organized them into two categories, which we still use today. One category is what we call analytical methods, where you actually look at and think about and examine your thoughts, etc. And there are all kinds of ways of doing this. And this isn't our Zen practice, but we find this in many schools of Buddhism. For example, you can look at the nature of your thought. You know, what pattern of thought do you actually see? For example, are you a rigid person? Are you a wishy-washy person? Are you a fiery person? And in Tibetan Buddhism, they talk about the meditations where you actually look at your thought and look at your responses, etc. And when you talk with other people, you look at how they respond as well, and you begin to see that those thoughts that come up actually have a pattern. If you will. And there are all kinds of analytical ways. Now, the other non-analytical approach is just an approach to calming the mind. And these are the approaches that are usually taught first because with a calm mind, you can actually later examine the mind, if you will. So I'm going to concentrate on some of these non-analytical methods, just to talk about a little bit about how we meditate. The first kind, and the easiest in a sense, conceptual sense, is what we call objectless meditation. And in Zen Buddhism, we refer to this as a shikantaza, which is just pure awareness. You know, just pure awareness. And so you sit there and whatever arises, you know, you just watch it arise. Whatever images, whatever thoughts, you're doing this in a non-judgmental way, if you will. So it's like looking out the window and seeing the clouds and seeing the mist and knowing that the bright sky is beyond there. And you just look at the mist and look at the clouds or look at the sediment, if you will, in a pure, non-judgmental way, if you can. You don't try to follow your thoughts. If you follow a thought, remember, you kind of come back to pure awareness, if you will. And when you're first starting, you just do this for a few minutes. You know, you don't have to do it for 30 minutes or 40 minutes or an hour. 30 seconds or just a minute of just pure awareness, if you will. You find that, as simple as it sounds, that this is actually one of the most difficult kinds of meditation. And when people say, well, when we say in Zen, particularly Soto Zen, that our major method of meditation is shikantaza, people say, "Whoa, that's really hard. You know, how can you do that, etc." And so most people start with some kind of what we call object meditation. Some kind of object meditation, and you kind of work your way up to pure awareness, if you will. Some of the simplest methods of object meditation are actually just concentrating upon our senses. You know, there they are, we have them to concentrate on, and we can use them as an object of meditation. So these are means of calming. Remember, we want to calm the mind, etc. The Buddhists actually recognize six senses. In the West, we recognize five. You know, we have sight, we have hearing, we have smell, we have taste, we have touch. But the Buddhists also recognize mind consciousness. And sometimes you get the image of, you know, you're a house, and your five senses are windows and doors looking out. These are doors of perception, if you will. And your mind consciousness is the occupant, basically. Of that particular house, if you will. When you do object meditation, basically focused on your senses, what you're doing is just resting your attention very lightly on this sensory information. You know, you're not grabbing it. It's not hard, if you will. So let's look at some of these kind of meditations real quickly. And meditating on physical sensations, if you take our introduction or meditation for beginners course, we actually do some of this. And a good example is if you just think of yourself and you just close your eyes for a minute and just think of yourself in objectless meditation, and there you are. And then place your attention on your forehead, and you can actually feel your forehead. And there's your attention. And then you just let go to objectless meditation. And then just come back to normal. And you actually do this, and you can practice this just for a couple minutes. And so you, you're going to meditate. Remember, your position is just a straight spine, a relaxed body, whether you're sitting or whatever you're doing, etc. And you just sit in objectless meditation for a minute if you can, and then focus on you. Feel your forehead, and that's where your attention is. And then you let it go. If you will. And eventually, you do this, so you can do a body scan where you move from your forehead to your cheeks, to your nose, to your throat, to your shoulders, etc., and then down through your body. And when I teach basic or introduction to meditation, we use Jon Kabat-Zinn's book called A Full Catastrophe Living, where he has a long body scanning section. He also has a nice CD, and so you don't have to think about what you're doing, but just listen to what he says, etc. And so this is a kind of meditation on physical sensations, if you will, called body scanning, if you will. And what you do, again, is you alternate between resting mind in objectless meditation and then resting on the mind. Another kind of meditation is resting on form, and these are object meditations, etc. And you can look at something like an apple or a candle, and they have color and they have shape. And the simplest thing is just to choose one of those. And think of an apple, if you will, and you can look at the redness of the apple, and you just rest your mind gently on the redness of the apple, or the yellowness of the candle, or the roundness of the apple. And when you do this for a while, you can actually close your eyes, and there's the apple, right? There's the candle, you know what I mean? And you can just, gently rest. You're not trying to grab onto this at all. If anything, this is a meditation of benign neglect, if you will. You know, it's in their periphery. You just kind of got it up there. You know, you're just kind of looking at it, etc. You can also meditate on sound. And we don't meditate on sound here, but they're wonderful CDs, meditation CDs, where you can listen to music. And you just listen to the music. And that's what you do. And you just gently put your attention on the music, etc. If you have somebody singing or saying something, it's really useful to have it not be in English. So you get used to just hearing voices, etc. So that when people talk to you, actually the content of their words in English have less of an effect. You know, they're just sounds, etc., whether praise or whatever. You know, you're just listening to them. They kind of come and go, if you will. So this is a simple bare awareness of sound as it strikes your ear, etc. And, of course, you can meditate on smell. You can be in the kitchen. You can meditate on taste, if you will. And other useful supports for this kind of object meditation is breathing in and breathing out. And if you take our Zazen class, etc., that this is what you're taught. You know what I mean? That you breathe in, you breathe out, you watch your breath, because your breath hopefully is always there, if you will. Now, when you breathe in, oftentimes there's a gap between you breathe in, you breathe out, and if you might want to count, breathe in, breathe out once, and that's a big gap. And the next thing you know, that your mind has fled off someplace. You know what I mean? There you are. You know, you're riding off someplace. So you have to gently bring it back. And so you can say, breathing in, you know, you're trying to fill the space, breathing in, breathing out, one, you know, things like this. So this is breathing in and breathing out exercise. And another very popular object meditation is just the mantra, and there are all kinds of mantras, and I'll just mention one, etc. This is just called the Om-Ah-Hung. And you just, as you breathe in, Om-Ah-Hung, and there are all kinds. And in this particular meditation, Om refers to the substance or form of the earth, and the Ah refers to the emptiness, and Hung refers to the joining of the two. And so when we chant here, we chant the Heart Sutra, and we talk about form and emptiness, etc. And so here in this mantra, you're joining the two together, if you will. You can also work with thoughts, and you can work with the flow of thoughts. Thoughts can be pretty powerful. I have a little story that sometimes you run across. And this is a story about a cowherd, if you will. Now, long ago in India, there was a cowherd who had spent most of his life looking after his master's cows. Finally, at the age of 60 or so, he realized, this is a boring job. Every day it's the same thing. Bring the cows out the pasture, watch them graze, and bring them back home. What am I supposed to learn from this? After thinking about the matter for a while, he decided he would give up his job and learn how to meditate, so he could at least free himself from the monotony of samsara, that is, a constant rebirth. After giving up his job, he traveled to the mountains. One day he saw a cave in which sat a meditation master. Upon seeing the meditation master, the cowherd felt very happy and approached him for advice on how to meditate. The master agreed and gave the cowherd basic instructions on how to meditate, using thoughts as a support. After receiving the instructions, the cowherd settled in a nearby cave and set himself to practice. Like most of us, he ran into problems right away. During his years as a cowherd, he had become very fond of his cows, and when he tried to practice what the Zen master had taught him, the only thoughts and images that appeared in his mind were those of cows he had taken care of. Though he tried hard to block the thoughts, the cows kept appearing, and the harder he tried, the more clearly they appeared. Finally exhausted, he went to the master and told him he was having terrible trouble carrying out his instructions. And when the master asked him what the problem was, the cowherd explained his difficulty. "That's not really a problem," the master told him. "I can teach you another method. It's called cow meditation." "What?" the cowherd asked, very surprised. "I'm serious," the master replied. "All you need to do is watch the images of the cows you see. Watch them as you lead them out to the pasture, as they graze, as you lead them back to the farm. Whatever thoughts about cars appear to you, just watch them." So the cowherd returned to his cave and sat down to practice with this new set of instructions. Because he wasn't trying to block his thoughts, this time his meditation proceeded very easily. He began to feel very peaceful and happy. He didn't miss his cows, and his mind grew calmer, more balanced, and more pliable. After a while, he went back to the master and said, "Okay, now I've completed cow meditation. What do I do next?" The master replied, "Very good. Now that you've learned to calm your mind, I'll teach you the second level of cow meditation. Here are the instructions. Meditate on your own body as a cow." So the cowherd went back to his cave and began practicing and instructing, thinking, "Okay, now I'm a cow. I have horns and hooves. I make the sound moo. I eat grass." As he kept on with his practice, he found that his mind became even more peaceful and happy than before. When he felt he had mastered this practice, he returned to the master and asked if there was a third level of instruction. "Yes," the master replied slowly. "For the third level of cow meditation, you have to focus on having horns." So once again, the cowherd returned to his cave to carry out his teacher's instructions, focusing only on the thought of having horns. He concentrated on the size of the horns, their placement, their color, the feeling of their weight on either side of his head. After a few months of practicing this way, he got up one morning and started to go outside to relieve himself. But as he tried to leave his cave, he felt something butting up against the sides of the cave's walls, making it impossible for him to get out. He reached up to figure out what the obstacle was, and found, to his surprise, that two very long horns had sprouted from the sides of his head. Turning his body sideways, he finally managed to get out of the cave and ran terrified to his teacher. "Look what happened," he shouted. "You gave me this cow meditation, and now I've grown horns. This is horrible. It's like a nightmare." The master laughed happily. "No, it's wonderful," he explained. "You've mastered the third level of cow meditation. Now you have to practice the fourth level. You have to think, now I'm not a cow, and I don't have horns." Dutifully, the cowherd went back to his cave and practiced the fourth level of cow meditation, thinking, "Now I don't have horns. Now I don't have horns. Now I don't have horns." After a few days of practicing this way, he woke up one morning and discovered that he could walk outside his cave without any difficulty at all. The horns had disappeared. Surprised, he ran to the master, announcing, "Look, I don't have horns anymore. How does this happen? When I thought I had horns, they appeared. When I thought I didn't have horns, they disappeared. Why?" The master replied, "The horns came and went because of the way you focused your mind. The mind is very powerful. It can make experiences seem very real. It can make them appear unreal." "Oh," the cowherd said. The master went on to explain, "Horns aren't the only things that appear and disappear according to the focus of your mind. Everything is like that. Your body, other people, the whole world, their nature is emptiness. Nothing truly exists except in your mind's perception. Recognizing that is pure vision." And of course, that's kind of a silly story, but we can think of our head, because of ego being so big that we can't leave the room. And we can think of us having horns because of envy or whatever, etc. And the main point is how truly powerful the mind is, and how it controls what we see. In using your thoughts as an object of meditation, you meet the crazy monkey head on. And if you've meditated a bit, you're familiar with the what's called monkey mind. And that is, you sit there and all kinds of thoughts jumble around, etc. I like these images because it really helps us. It really helps us understand better what we encounter, give them labels, and make them less threatening and less forceful, etc. So what's a monkey do? A crazy monkey. And the first thing it does, it chatters, right? And it just chatters. And so you sit there and try to meditate, and all this chatter comes up, right? This neuronal gossip, if you want to call it that, if you will. Another thing a monkey does, it leaps from tree to tree. And we're sitting there, and our thought is moving from one thought to another, from one area to another, etc., just moving all around. Buddhist meditation, it helps to have a really good sense of humor. And I'm convinced that you don't wake up without a really good sense of humor. You can see the monkey chattering. You can see that monkey jumping all around. You know it's in your mind, etc. And rather than becoming distraught, you just say, that monkey. That monkey, if you will. Something else a monkey does, it's a monkey's greedy and grasping. And so in India, the way you capture a monkey is you take some peanuts and you put it in the bottom of a pot with a narrow top, a round bottom. Peanuts are in there. The monkey puts his hand in there, grabs the peanut, and of course forms a fist. And when he tries to raise his arm out of the pot, of course it's stuck. And of course all he has to do to become free is let go of the peanuts. But of course he won't let go of the peanuts. And so there he is with this big heavy pot, and he gets caught, if you will. And of course, this happens to us as well, that we grasp onto something pleasurable. We grasp onto something we don't like, etc. We won't let it go. And of course, in our practice, when we sit in our cushion, we should be able to raise our clenched fist up high. It's like, I am stuck, I'm caught, I'm grasping, etc., if you will. But this is a crazy monkey. And of course, it's always with us, and we want to really recognize it if we can. Now, many of us have very active minds. We have active monkey minds. And so we think, I'm not a good candidate for meditation, etc. The antidote really is to think, seeing the crazy monkey as really as a meditation support, as really an object, if you will, for your meditation. Most of us have very active minds, etc. One way to think about this, again, using labels, and I like labels and things, is to think of all of these as whoops experiences. You're there, you're supposed to be concentrating on your breath, let's say, and suddenly chatter, and you leap to a different tree, and you lose your focus, etc., and there you go someplace, etc., if you will. And so you can say, whoops, there I go again. And of course, one way is to think, I just can't meditate, I just can't focus. Another way is just to think, use that Buddha's experience as a real focus of meditation, etc. There you go, just focus on it, etc. So whoops can be a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful thing, just like the crazy monkey can be a wonderful aid, etc. Watch it jump around, just watch it. And again, we watch it, calmly. We're just resting our mind on it in a non-attached, non-judgmental way, if you will. So again, you can use your thoughts, the crazy monkey, if you will, as supports of meditation. And again, if you do this through time, you find that thoughts settle down, you tend to be calmer, etc., more serene, more compassionate. And the ancient meditation teachers used to refer to this progression, if you will, with three different images of water. And the first image was what they called the waterfall experience. And that is that you're sitting there trying to meditate, and thoughts, perceptions, images just are cascading down, like a waterfall. And if we were up along the North Shore, along Lake Superior right now, when everything is thawing, we'd see that ice and water and dirt and rocks, are just tumbling over that waterfall, etc. When we often start meditating, for most people, this is what you first experience. And you come to a Zen center and somebody says, I think you have to meditate. And you have to calm yourself. And so you come in and you sit on your cushion or you sit on your chair. And what do you run into? The waterfall experience. And one reason is that you haven't watched your mind before. And you haven't trained your mind. And so naturally, the very first experience you get are these cascading thoughts. And so you learn a little bit about, well, this is a misperception about what meditation is. That I'm going to come and I'm going to sit on the mat and I'm going to be calm, etc., and all of that. And instead, you have the waterfall experience. And so usually, a number of things happen when you experience the waterfall. The first impulse is to try to block it up. And of course, if you've tried to block a waterfall up, it just doesn't work. It just cascades down, etc. A second experience is just the raw waterfall experience. And what that is, that when you sit and rest on your thoughts, you're supposed to observe them quietly as they arise and fall. The waterfall, there's so many thoughts, that you just don't see them. And, there they go, and they're rushing by, and you really can't observe them in a gentle way, etc. So a third experience with a waterfall is what's called the hook experience, and that is that, you want to observe a thought, and so when one goes by, you grab it, etc., and you hold on to it, instead of just watching it go by. And of course, by grabbing onto it, you're making it more real than thought should be. And remember, they're just bubbles that are just coming, they're just going, etc. But if you keep working and just observe the waterfall, etc., after a while, just like the waterfall up north along the North Shore, the spring surge begins to lessen. By the middle of the summer, there's a nice stream. By the fall, things are actually pretty much down to a trickle. And this actually happens. And so when that happens, you enter what meditation teachers call the river experience. And that is the water is still moving. You're still having thoughts arising. But things are much slower. And you begin to appreciate, really, you begin to see, really, the underlying joy, the underlying goodness, etc., that basically you have. The crazy monkey is still there. If you have a real active imagination, that monkey's in a canoe. It's on that river. It's paddling around. It's making faces at you and things like this. It's there, etc. But things have really smoothed down, if you will. And then eventually you enter what's called the lake experience. The lake experience. And this is like a lake without ripples, just a deep mountain lake, etc. You feel very smooth, wide, open in your meditation, if you will. You begin to find that genuine happiness and that bliss, etc., that non-conceptual awareness that's a part of your Buddha nature. Okay, it's there. And if you read some of Eckhart Tolle's books that are very popular these days, he talks about when he first awoke and first entered the lake experience, if you will, which for him was very sudden, that he spent 2 years in London just sitting on park benches being joyful. He must have looked like a homeless person or something like that. But anyway, this idea, that this pure joy that you actually feel. There's another a traditional Buddhist analogy that really kind of captures and reflects that same kind of transition. And this is the idea of a lotus emerging from the mud. And the lotus plant starts in the mud, etc. And then as it grows, it emerges from the mud. And as it becomes a full lotus, it actually repels mud and grit and things like this. So just a little bit, when you start, and this is primarily for people who are kind of starting, take it slow, and you don't have to sit there for 30 or 40 minutes. You can just do a minute or a minute and a half. And it reminds me of the story, one last story, and the meditation master comes to a small village, and he talks about meditation. And a person gets very excited. This guy gets very excited and says, I'm going to become a meditation master. So he gives his house away. And he gives all of his goods away, and he runs up into the hills, and he finds a cave, etc. And he sits there, and he starts to meditate. And by the end of the first day, he's really uncomfortable, and it starts to rain. And at the end of the third day, he says, I don't like this, but I can't go back. Everyone will laugh at me, etc. And so by the end of the fifth day, he's had it, and so he goes back and asks for his house back and all his goods. And he talks to the meditation master, and the meditation master says, just take it slow, you know, 1 minute at a time. So that's about all I have to say.